Hello, and welcome to another exciting episode of The Big Web Show, Everything Web That Matters. I'm your host, Jeffrey Zeldman, and today's guest is going to be the wonderful, legendary designer, Andrew Clark. This episode is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. For a free trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and use the offer code FREELANCE. That's all caps, FREELANCE. And if you don't know how to spell freelance, that could be a problem that even Squarespace can't help you with. And so, with no further ado, this is Andrew Clark. He is a designer at Stuff and Nonsense, a small web boutique in the UK. He's an author and speaker known for design work, books, conference presentations, and contributions to the community. He's written two books, Transcending CSS and Hard-Boiled Web Design, and at this point has probably given close to, 100 conference presentations and workshops. Something crazy.
No, it's not that many. It's about 60 at the last count, I think.
And how long ago did you start, by the way?
Well, it was 2005. It was the year that we met, first of all. Do you remember the first At Media conference in London?
Yes, I do.
When you came over. And that was the very first time. And there was a bunch of us that had never done anything like that before. Me and Andy Budd and Jeremy Keith and, loads of people.
None of you had spoken before?
No, none of us had actually ever stood on a stage in front of an audience before. And it was Patrick Griffiths, who was a developer on the scene at the time, that had decided that it would be great. I think you might have done some in Event Apart, so I can't remember now. But he decided, maybe in the wake of South By, that there should be a European web conference, and he was going to organize the first one. So he invited, a bunch of people whose names everybody would have heard of, you included. And Doug Bowman was there, I think.
Yep.
I'm not sure whether Dan Cederholm was there, but Derek Featherstone was definitely there. Joe Clark was definitely there. Luminaries of the time. And a bunch of people that, just made up the numbers. Me and Jeremy and Andy Budd and a bunch of others.
Not really. You guys had already, back in 2005, you were all part of a coterie of British design talent, web design talent. It was like proud member, I remember. I think, I don't know whether John Hicks or you did the illustration for...
It was the Brit Pack.
The Brit Pack.
Yeah, well, it was because we'd been... I mean, I set up my blog in... Actually, it was May 2004. So, God, we're coming up to the 10th anniversary.
Yep.
This year, by the way, this year is amazing for groundbreaking, industry-changing articles that are on a list apart.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
No, but it's true. I mean, just at the end of last year, we had Doug Bowman's Sliding Doors of CSS. I think November was the anniversary of that. Mountaintop Corners, Faux Columns, Dan Cederholm's two big posts. They were 2004. Dave Shea's CSS Sprites.
Yep.
That was 2004.
Yep.
And there was a post, it was also 2004, I think, by Patrick Griffiths again, who did the whole, use M's as units for laying out pages.
He called it elastic design.
Elastic design, exactly. And, I can't believe that was, 10 years ago. Where's it gone?
That was 10 years ago.
So it's a big year for anniversaries.
Yes. And that's very true. 2005 will be your 10th and my 20th. Personal site anniversary, but yours is prettier. So,
so back to the At Media thing. Yeah. We'd never done that before. And I think, to be honest, Patrick was taking a punt on a lot of people and it seemed to go okay. I can remember that I had my notes actually written on paper. I'd made a pad with, I don't know what you call them now, but they were kind of, prompts on paper. And when I got to the end of a series of notes, I would screw up the piece of paper and throw it behind me on the stage.
Oh, that's brilliant.
And I did it like completely subconsciously, not really knowing that it was being picked up by the mic. So every time every 5 minutes, and I kind of throw it behind.
That was the beginning of your cavalier. What would you say? You come on. You don't just give a talk. You're not like a professor. I mean, you do have a beard like a professor now. You look kind of like George Bernard Shaw now, which is nice. But you never. You always sort of. It was always a performance. There's always an aspect of performance when you speak. As I trust, you know, there always will be, because it's lovely. So throwing the stuff away was the beginning, and you know, a year later, you were giving talks with, you know, martinis on stage.
By the way, the beard, I prefer more George the Fifth.
Okay.
Or possibly Tsar Nicholas. They had some impressive beards back then.
They did.
That was the era of beards. The Victorians knew how to do a beard.
It was the era of men and almost total social repression and sexual repression and beards.
Listen, they had beards. And beards that you could hide a badger in, some of them.
And they believed in duty. It was expected that a man would sacrifice his family or the love of his life in order to give his, you know, in order to die for his country, or
not for his beard, obviously.
Not for his beard, no. But for the king's beard.
They did know how to do beards.
They did.
No, I think that the task of a performer, of a speaker, I would say performer, the task of a speaker is to do something which is memorable for some reason or another, because, you know, nobody's going to remember everything that you said, but you want them to take away two or three points. You know, you want them to come and go, that's what that talk was about. And, you know, I think that it also helps if, you know, if you can lift an audience or entertain or make them laugh or do something.
It helps them remember.
Because just like people say, you know, well, you know, when you're teaching children a subject, oh, well, it helps if you make it fun. Well, you know, I don't think that we ever should really grow out of that. So
no.
If you can pull stupid stunts like, you know, pretend to have martinis on stage, well, because it wasn't really a martini, it was actually apple juice.
I know.
But the audience don't know that.
Right.
That's still a big secret to them. We might be blowing my cover.
I think it's okay.
They'll just have to learn to live with it.
You're not doing that this year, though.
No, I'm not going to do that this year. I am going to do something different. Not different for me, because I've done it a couple of times, but I think slightly different maybe for an Event Apart audience, which is, again, I'm going to do the talk without slides.
Next week in Atlanta.
Yes.
Right. Which I will be. I will be there and we'll be watching you next week in Atlanta at Event Apart. Right. And I've seen you do this before. You just get up and talk with no slides at all.
Yes. And I've done several different versions of it where the first time I did it, I had a backdrop. And then the second time I took that away. The one that you saw in Cardiff, I didn't have anything at all on there. I have notes. You know, I have cue cards, which are on the Mac. So it's not quite auto cue, but, you know, I know what I'm going to say next. And I think that I've seen several people do it, and I heard John Gruber and Merlin Mann talking about this on, I think it was the talk show, actually.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember the episode number, but it was a good few weeks ago. And they were talking about giving talks without slides and how much more focused the audience is on what you're saying when they don't have a slide to distract them.
Oh, that makes so much sense. It really does.
And also, and to be honest, and, you know, I talk openly on your show about the conference. An Event Apart is such a big stage. I mean, I don't mean physically, because, you know, people have fallen off it. We're not going to say who.
Yeah, we know who.
But, and we never let them forget it. But it's a big stage. And one of the things that does is it puts an enormous amount of pressure on a speaker. And I know some people will say, no, oh, well, listen to him. You know, he has it so hard. He gets invited to these things. But, you know, there's an awful lot of pressure that, you know, either gets put on you or you put on yourself, because you want to do the best for you as an organizer. You want to do the best for the audience. And, you know, you want to stand up there alongside everybody else who's doing such an awesome job.
I shouldn't say it because, you know, I founded the conference with Eric Meyer, but I feel that pressure too. I'm glad people do. And I hate it myself as a speaker. I'm used to, I never phone it in. I always take it very seriously, but the anxiety that I have about giving a talk at an event apart is like no other.
Yeah, I've never experienced anything like it, and I've done bigger audiences in terms of number, and I've done bigger venues. I mean, the one that we were at in Cardiff was an incredible venue. There was 1,200 people in the auditorium. It was insane. Mm-hmm. But the amount of pressure that you feel at an event apart is different to everything else. And alongside that, you've got brilliant designers who must spend months working on their slides.
Including you, well, which is why it's interesting. It's interesting that you would, it's almost like you're a beautiful dancer who is doing a radio play. Do you know what I mean? Because you have, one of the ways that you entertain and make yourself memorable is that you make these amazing slideshows, and you've decided not to do that this year, which is an interesting constraint to put on yourself as a designer.
Yeah, it is. But I think I can probably do it this time. I can do a better talk without them. And also, to be honest, in terms of focus, not having the pressure of thinking that I have to compete with the likes of, let's say, Luke Rabluski, who always does incredibly cheeky looking slides, you know, in his style, or an Ethan Marcotte, for example. Those things are like, those slides are like Rembrandts.
Yeah. I agree. I always feel like a hack when I look at Ethan's slides, like a talentless hack, and I should just basically do word art or something. I might as well. I feel like I should just set it in Comic Sans and be done with it because he's so brilliant at that.
Everything that I do just feels like a PowerPoint default compared to somebody like Ethan or Dan Cederholm, for example.
Yeah, well.
So.
It feels that way to you. I think that your work is beautiful, but I know.
Well,
it.
Thank you. But
and I understand that feeling. I understand that feeling when you're up against really, really gifted, visually gifted people like that.
So I just decided to take that pressure away and to focus on what I'm going to say more. And if I had, you know, a certain amount of time to do the talk and it was going to be, you know, kind of 60% words, 40% slides, well, now I've got 100% to spend on the words. And that's how I've been looking at it.
When you're not speaking, of course, you work. And you work at... not that speaking isn't work, but you do design work and you run your own studio, and you recently redesigned your site. What was the thinking behind the redesign, and what was the idea behind, right on your front page, you have an article about a more flexible design process where you talk in great detail about, or in some detail about sprints and the way you run projects and how you collaborate, which days of the week they can expect to see you and all that. And I wonder why the article's called A More Flexible Design Process. It's on stuffandnonsense.co.uk, right on the front page. And I'm just wondering why you decided to be so out front with that. Before we even talk about the redesign, let's just talk about the content of the redesign. Why did you decide to be so out front explaining to clients how they should expect to work with you?
We had a project that I worked on. It was 2 or 3 years ago. And at the end of that project, the client, we were sitting down having coffee, and the client said to me, you know, can I give you some advice? And I was like, yeah, sure. He said, the experience that I've had working with you does not come across in your website. So I wouldn't have understood that I was going to have this experience when I looked at your website. You're not communicating that. And nobody had ever really said that to me before. And it was a bit of a shock because, you know, we all talk about branding, and obviously branding is not your logo. It's much more than that. And I thought, wow, you know, I'm not communicating anything about the way that we work and the experience that people are going to have when when they come through the website.
Wow.
Not in terms of the design and the information. So I thought about it and I thought, well, I bet now the majority of people, unless you've been in prison for the last 15 years or, you know, I don't know, in Middlesbrough, you were probably like, have you ever been to Middlesbrough?
No, but it just works.
No. Or Peterborough. You will likely have worked on a web project at some point. You know, even if you're starting a new business or, you know, you will have done something. You will have had some experience of a web project in some capacity. You know, when we started back 10 years ago or more, fewer people had had their first website made. And now they're probably on 3 or 4 or 5.
Right.
And along the way, they will have had good experiences and they will have had bad experiences. Generally speaking, people don't seem to work with the same design team twice. I think it's like, you know, the old ad days that they think, well, we need a new look, so we're going to go for a new team.
Right.
So people have had one experience already, or two or three, and those have been good or bad. So they're going to be carrying that with you. So when it comes to choosing a new designer, if you look around at, I don't, you know, I'm not doing my fellow designers a disservice here, but when you do look at a lot of designer sites, they are pretty samey. You know, everybody says the same stuff.
They say it's user focused, and they show really great work, and they focus on the work.
And, exactly, and the work is
the, or on the graphic design of the work more than what problems they were solving. Or
I think that's right. So, and if I ever see another, you know, another portfolio that has things, has work stuck into iPhones and iPads, you know, you just want to kind of, you know, you want to go.
You're tired of that, but isn't that a designer's way of just letting a client who may not be that, you know, that hep, know that, you know, we can put stuff in these devices. We can put you here because, you know, Joe's nuts and bolts, who might be your client, might not know that. You know, I mean, it might be tiresome to you, and it might be tiresome to the marketing director of Starbucks, but it might be news to most of us. Have clients who are not, you know, the biggest brands and the biggest organizations, and they may not know as much as we know.
We don't either, but I think that there are more creative ways of showing off the fact that, you know, design's flexible now. I mean, you know, sure. Show it off in your own site.
As you do at stuffandnonsense.co.uk, where you have this Planet of the Apes header, which you can show or hide, and which is, well, how would you describe what's going on with it as one squashes, preferably seated at a large monitor, as one squashes and stretches the page? Not only do the expected responsive things happen with, you know, column layouts and type size and so on, but the apes and the depth, the apes, they go apeshit, basically, I guess.
Hey, do you know what? We're not actually allowed to say Planet of the Apes because Josh and I, Josh is Josh Cleland. He's the illustrator. We should put a link in your show notes to Josh's work. He drew the apes, and we wrestled long and hard with the fact that we wanted to do some ape-related thing, you know, for, you know, my own vanity, really. And we thought that we could do something funny with it too, but we couldn't make it Planet of the Apes because
right.
We don't have a license for that. You know, we haven't paid $10,000 for that.
I know you love Planet of the Apes, but I this is apes in spacesuits holding ray guns, so it's
they're not Planet of the Apes. They're in red boiler suits, but instead of they're in red boiler suits like Conquest of the Planet of the Apes, which is probably the second best of the early movies. But instead of them holding rifles and riot shields, we had them holding water pistols and umbrellas, and it just seemed to be like a funny gag, really.
So I could draw the Flintstones, but instead of a dinosaur, Fred Flintstone has a Doberman Retriever.
Okay, so we are on dodgy ground.
Right. That's all I'm saying. No, that's what I'm trying to say poorly. We're all on dodgy ground. Yeah.
We're on dodgy ground.
Yeah, but I think it's, you're not, it's not an explicit reference, and you're not commercial. You're not, it's not, you're not commercial. You're not making money off it or pretending to be something.
We're hopefully not passing it off as if it is the thing, but anybody that knows me will know what the references are.
Yes.
But the idea behind that was we've done several headers. Josh has worked on three, including this one. And we like to change that header roughly every 6 months because it's just fun and it gives you an incentive to, you know, play around with ideas. And the first one that we did was a mod on a scooter who got older.
I remember that.
Got older as the window got wider. Because, you know, if you think about most of our sites, you know, your site or my site or, you know, lots of our peers, we have two audiences. We have people that come to us because they're in the industry and they're reading what we write. So there's a certain amount of kind of geek chic involved.
Right.
But also we have people that we want to hire us.
Yes.
And therefore, we've got these two audiences. And what I like to do with the header is I like to do something where, you know, potential clients will look at it and they'll go, wow, that was different to the guy down the road. You know, they have apes. But at the same time, I want geeks to be finding the Easter eggs. You know, there's a whole ton of CSS3 Easter eggs in that header that, you know, I don't talk about. And it's just really nice for geeks to be able to find it. You know, and I kind of like that stuff.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. I want to talk more about the dual audience. I want to talk more about the thing that you said at the very beginning about promoting yourself not just as a set of skills, and I think very apropos for listeners, not just as a set of skills, but the experience, what it's like to work with you. Because after all, we are designing user experiences, and the experience we provide to a client is one of those user experiences and a very important one. But before we get back to that and lots of other stuff, I need to give thanks and praise to sponsor Squarespace again. This episode is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. For a free trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and use the offer code freelance. Squarespace is constantly improving their platform with new features, new designs, and even better support. They have beautiful designs for you to start with. It's really true. I don't know if you've looked at this. It's really totally true. They do have amazingly beautiful designs for you to start with and all the style options you need to create a unique website for you or your business. Squarespace has over 20 highly customizable templates for you to choose from. It's incredibly easy to use, but if you want some help, Squarespace has an amazing support team that works 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It starts at just $8 a month, which most people listening can probably afford. And every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look great on every device, every time. Start a trial with no credit card required and start building your website. When you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure to use the offer code freelance to get 10% off and to show your support for the Big Web Show. That's us. And thanks. Thank you, Squarespace. And now, Andrew, back to you.
Support this show by supporting them.
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah, because if you like the show, if you like guests like Andrew Clark, if you like hearing me while you're jogging or walking to work or taking a train, then consider our sponsors. The way we only work with really great sponsors who we know offer value to the specific kinds of listeners that we have. That's our deal. Stuff and Nonsense is the name of your company. Which is kind of a fussy British Victorian, I'm not sure Americans even say it. I think my Canadian grandmother said it.
Do you know where it comes from?
I do not.
Well, back in the early 90s, I worked at an ad agency in South London, and we had an account man that was sort of famously vague when he brought briefs into the studio, and he would say, they want a bit of this and a bit of that and all that malarkey, Clarky, because he was in London.
He was Cockney.
He was from South London, but yeah, that's the only accent I can do. You know, there was
so he called you malarkey.
No, he said
all that malarkey.
All that malarkey, all that bullshit, all that, we can't say it on air. Anyway, so you know, I thought, oh, that, and that kind of stuck, really. That whole kind of malarkey, clarky thing stuck. And I'd never really had a nickname when I was growing up. Nobody called me anything, you know, repeatable when I was at school.
That's sad. Why is that?
Well, I don't know. Did you have a nickname at school?
Oh, God. So the nickname that I wanted for myself was Thundercloud. But Mini Kosher. Mini Kosher was one. When I moved to Pittsburgh, I think I was the second person of Jewish descent in that neighborhood, and they just did, you know, the kids didn't really know what to do about that. They would like start conversations by, you know, talking about Nazis. I mean, it was weird. So my best friend called me Mini Kosher. So that will give you some idea. And yeah, we're going down a very sad, dark path.
We don't want to
do that.
So Ray, I think this guy's name was, used to come into the studio with these briefs. And then the whole malarkey, clarky thing stuck. So that was fine. And then I think, I can't remember when we registered now, mid-90s, malarkey.co.uk for the domain name. And then when we were setting up the business, we moved up to where we live now. And we needed to set up the business. And one day, literally sitting in the office with the accountant, we needed to come up with a name to register for the company. And we looked in the dictionary. And one of the definitions of malarkey is the one that we can say on air is stuff and nonsense. And that was it. That was the name of the company.
Wow. I like that story.
Yeah. It was, you know, that was funny. It was funny actually, because during your last election, Joe Biden mentioned malarkey. He said, I think, to Paul Ryan, who was the other vice president candidate, I think.
That sounds right.
He said, with the greatest of respect, that's just a bunch of malarkey. And for the next 2 days, Twitter was unusable for me.
Because?
Because everybody was using @malarkey instead of just putting, you know, the word malarkey in the thing. It's like, that's it. I'm off Twitter for like 2 or 3 days now.
Which is your Twitter handle for those who don't know? Right. Malarkey is Andy Clark's Twitter handle. So, yeah, I can see how that would have been a problem. That's a really American thing where a regular guy like Joe Biden would probably say bullshit, but since he's on television or since he wants to present a more clean-cut image, he says malarkey or bunk or whatever, and it's very old-fashioned. It's you know, of his generation, I think, and it's kind of sweet, but it's also kind of diabolically clever because it's like a dog whistle in a way. He's saying to people who know what he's saying this is bullshit, but he's being polite about it, you know, by using this strange archaic euphemism. Maybe, I don't know, maybe it gets used a lot more in England.
No, it doesn't really. No, okay. And I feel guilty sometimes because there are people that have the surname Malarkey and they pop up on Twitter every now and again. And I do feel bad that I've stolen somebody's name.
Yeah, you know, people have names. You're not really responsible for that. It's a, you know, that's a tough name to be born with, I think. Right?
I've never really thought about that, but yeah.
Yeah. What you have been independent for what? 10 years?
16 years.
16 years. Okay. You don't, although you work, you do collaborate on projects at times with, you know, especially with illustrators, I've noticed. Well, let's start there. You tend to work with illustrators more than anyone I know in the field. You do that a lot for a lot of your projects and a lot of the personal project. What's that? What's the value of that? What's the appeal of that, do you think?
I like custom stuff. I like unique stuff. And with the best will in the world, sometimes not every business or company or organization that you work with has access to great photography. And sometimes stock photography that you buy, you know, it's not special enough. Whereas with an illustrator, the sky's the limit. You can have anything that you want. And of course, you can, if you pick the right illustrator and they really understand what you're trying to achieve, you'll get real personality in the work, which you might not do if you're buying stock photography, for example.
Yeah, definitely not.
So I love working with illustrators.
Where do you find all of yours?
Well, this is the thing. I found Josh on Twitter, on Dribbble. I just did a bit of a, you know, a bit of a dive into Dribbble one evening and liked his style. And there was a few people. I think there were three people that I contacted for the original mods on Scooter's illustration, and one didn't come back to me. One was ridiculously expensive. I mean, you know, I do appreciate that, you know, illustration isn't and shouldn't be cheap, but this was more than my budget anyway. Shouldn't say ridiculous. It was expensive, but it was more expensive than I could afford.
Right.
And Josh was slightly more expensive than I thought I could afford, but I liked the way that he approached the whole conversation. And this, you know, goes back to what you were asking earlier on about kind of laying out how you work and that whole user experience thing. I just liked the way that he sounded. You know, I liked the way that he wrote to me in emails.
Yes.
And that's where that kind of relationship started. So
it's weird. The relationship is a really important part of it. Sometimes if you can kid with somebody, and that's true with clients too. At Happy Cog now, it's I don't do the new business anymore. But when I did, when Happy Cog was a lot smaller, basically, I had to kind of fall in love with somebody, or at least be able to flirt with them in some way. I don't mean romantically, but I mean like them, just like them, like what they were doing, really like what their business was about, make a weird comment and have them not freak out by it, but kind of like it and say something equally strange back. So, yeah, I get that. You also uniquely... Well, not uniquely, but I would say you do a lot of writing for a designer. Do you think that has been helpful in your career?
What, writing of my own stuff?
Yeah, writing of your own stuff, as well as books, blog posts, articles.
Well, the whole, going back to what we were talking about right at the beginning, I mean, if I hadn't have started a blog back in 2004, I wouldn't have been invited to speak at that first conference, and the very... You know, there's a very strong likelihood that, you know, we wouldn't be having this conversation now had it not been for that strange turn of events.
What made you start?
I think it was, and this is where a lot of us started at the time, because there was a, you know, this whole kind of silly Brit pack with the underpants thing was in retaliation, is too strong a word, but it was... at the time anyway, you know, we were reading things on A List Apart. We were reading Doug Bowman and Dave Shea and Dan Cederholm, and Sean Inman was very active at that point. And we just thought, well, you know, let's, you know, if we've got something to say, let's, you know, let's give it a silly kind of double entendre meaning and, you know, and do it ourselves. And I think the writing was important then.
Not so much now?
Not so much now. And I find that there's less for me to say, and my interests are different now than they once were. And I think that the overall atmosphere for for writing has changed quite a lot. I mean, back when I was, you know, originally writing stuff, I wrote a lot about CSS. Well, I don't do that anymore. There are far younger, more cleverer people.
Boy, do I know that.
And, you know, I not only do I not want to compete with that, but, you know, I can't compete with that. And my interests are different now.
Mm-hmm. Are they so more business, or are they more process? Are they more, you know, big picture graphic design? What are those new interests?
We've been concentrating. I hired another designer to work with me a year ago. So it's been 13 months now that I've had somebody that works with me side by side 3 days a week. And that's been a wonderful experience, actually, because for all the years prior to that, although I collaborated with people and, you know, my wife sits alongside, having another creative person in the room has been very different. I haven't had that since I worked in agencies, you know, 20 years ago. So we've been just geeking out on design work. You know, it's been lovely. And that's, I've not really been motivated to write a lot of that stuff down unless I've got a bee in my bonnet about something. Because most of the time we're just busy enjoying doing nice design work. And that's what's interested me. But also having somebody here that's taking care of a lot more of the kind of visual direction of things, particularly when it comes to client work, that's freed me up a little bit to think more about the business and about how we do things. And that's why, you know, if I do write about something, it's much more likely to be about the business side of it or the, you know, the human interaction side of it. You know, based on experience, I don't kind of come at it from some kind of academic, philosophical point of view, you know?
Right.
It's you know, it's purely experience. I mean, you know, we all make mistakes. And if I do write about something, it's going to be about that rather than anything else.
The name change from Andy Clark to Andrew Clark. Well, not really an official name change, but I think you and I have talked about this story. But is there anything you want to say about that?
It's really hard to get used to. The backstory was, and I've talked about this before, but you know, Andrew Clark was not the name that I was born with. It was a name that I picked up through family circumstances along the way. You know, I'm a Doyle. You know, I'm from Irish stock. So when I was growing up, I had my name changed to fit in with my family at the time. You know, my father had died, so, you know, and the family had moved on. And I felt uncomfortable being the only one in the family that was called Doyle. I was also uncomfortable being called Andrew because that was something that his family had always called me. And whenever somebody mentioned that, it brought back things that I didn't really want to think about.
Mm.
It brought back a lot of feelings of, you know, loss and frustration and sadness and anger, really. And I dealt with that through a name change. You know, I one day said, you know, call me Andy, you know, from now on. Because I think I was trying to leave that kind of uncomfortable stuff behind. And I carried that around for, you know, the next 35 years, I suppose. And I carried all of those sort of bad emotions around with me as well. And I'm not afraid to talk about it. You know, I had some therapy. I went to therapy a couple of years ago for a year. And part of dealing with that was unloading a lot of these feelings. So I could talk about things for the first time, and I could talk about how I felt about that whole kind of family background thing. And now when I, you know, when I talk about my father or anything that happened, I don't have that kind of overwhelming sense of sadness anymore, which is, you know, what I had before. So I thought, well, you know, can you do the Andrew thing? You know, can you actually do that? You know, maybe it was nice. Maybe it would be nice to be called that. That's what he called me. So I just started to experiment with it. And at the beginning of the year, I thought, okay, let's just try this. And I didn't announce it. I didn't say to anybody from now on, I didn't announce on Twitter, this is what I want you to call me. I just changed my profiles. And that's how that's come about. And it feels odd when you say it, and when other people say it, it feels as if they're talking about somebody else. It doesn't feel like my name yet.
I get it. I grew up Jeff, right? And then my first ex-wife called me Jeffrey, and it was the thing that I kept from that marriage. We were married less than a year. But it was really, I loved the way she said Jeffrey. And so after that, I called myself Jeffrey. But when I'm with my dad or my brother, they call me Jeff, and there's no way I'm going to say to them, yeah, it's Jeffrey now. I mean, right? So I get it. And it's weird. It's weird that we are in the business of creating identities for other people, understanding other people's identities and translating them to the web or creating brand identities. And it's weird the extent to which we've done it ourselves growing up as well. I wonder if that's true for all people, or if there's a special kind of lostness that you can experience early in your life that helps you be a designer.
I don't know whether it helps me be a designer, but I think what it did was I think I chose a pseudonym. I think I chose an alias all those years ago. And I went through life living under that alias. It was like I was on witness protection or something. It's like I'd been, it's like I'd taken myself and, you know, up sticks and was living somewhere in central Montana, working in a gas station or something. You know, it was me, but it wasn't me. And I feel recently that I'm not burdened by that anymore. Which is a good thing. You know, you accumulate baggage over your life.
Yeah, that sounds great.
Sometimes people accumulate it very early. And of course, you know, that has a tremendous impact on, you know, how you live your life sometimes. And I do feel that over the last couple of years, I've lost that, which is a good thing. And I've lost a lot of the, I've lost a lot of the anger, and I've lost a lot of the kind of hyper competitiveness that I had for all those years too. And that's probably not a good thing for business, but it's good for me personally.
Yeah, it could be. We have to take another little sponsor break just for a moment. Speaking of names, if you've registered a domain name, you know that companies make it a really unpleasant experience. They make it complicated to search for what you're looking for, or they try to sell you up with stuff you don't need on your way to the shopping cart. Hover is honest. They don't believe in heavy-handed upselling or charging you for something that should just be there. Hover is the best way to buy and manage domain names. When you have a great idea, you want to secure a domain name for it. You want something catchy and memorable to represent your online identity. Hover gives you exactly what you need to get the job done, and people love Hover. This is definitely true. When you're looking for the best place for a domain, geeks, developers, designers, and programmers are keen on Hover because they know Hover has the best tools and support. But you don't have to be an expert to get a domain. The service is simple enough that to use that you'll be comfortable figuring it out yourself. And the Hover support team is always ready to give you a hand. Hover truly takes all the hassle and friction out of registering a domain. You can start building your web presence right away and take control of what people find when they search for you or your business online. It's easy. All you have to do is search for a few keywords, and Hover will show you the best available options and suggestions. Hover has a clean and simple website, so you don't have to mess around with a complicated interface, unlike some domain registrars we could mention. In less than 5 minutes, you can find the domain name you want and get it up and running and get started actually realizing your idea. They've got a huge variety of domain extensions like .com, .net, and country codes to best suit your needs. Hover has a .com, .net, .io, so you can get just about anything. When you call, a real-life person's ready to help with anything you throw at them, and they'll get on it right away. Hover customer support knows their stuff, and they're friendly, so getting your problem solved is quickly and easily accomplished. Give Hover a try. Thank you, Hover. And now back to Andrew. You know, my real first name is Lewis.
I did know that.
Yeah, you knew that. And some other time we'll tell that story. But right now.
Martin and Lewis.
Nice. I've just noticed something on your website. Although I hate to use words like flat design, there's definitely a more flat print-like aesthetic going on, if you don't mind my saying so, in Stuff and Nonsense, as well as other things. But there's a button that says start a project with us that kind of looks a little bit 3D. You know what I'm talking about? Your little red button. You do know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
You gave... It's small. It's not gigantic. You're not like a client going, make it as the biggest thing on the page. But you obviously want business, and you used just a touch of 3D-ness on that one single element on the page. I'm going to assume that was a deliberate choice.
I'm really glad that you noticed it. Yes. Do we have to talk about flat design?
Nope.
I think that people often confuse flat design with lack of subtlety. And I've heard people say that flat design is easier and therefore maybe
it's much harder.
Spend time, you know, on doing other things, you know, researching or going to the pub or whatever it happens to be.
It's much harder. It's much harder to do it, to make an effective design without all those background textures and drop shadows and all those other cribs that we have all been guilty of relying on.
Well, exactly. And I think that you can still have tremendous subtlety in a site. I mean, what are you losing? You're losing gradients and you're losing shadows. Well, big deal. There's still a tremendous opportunity to do very detailed, very exquisite work when the colors are flat. I mean, it's not like we're painting these things with poster paints. They don't have to be crude, and you can include a lot of subtlety. It's not flat does not necessarily mean simple. And I think that it is nice, you know, in the case of a single button, just to kind of, you know, yeah, let's draw attention to that. Let's sort of, you know, shock people out of the general kind of flatness by, you know, here's a big button and you should press it.
There's still, like in your work for Liwa House in Kenya, there's still, even though it could, you know, it could be called flat design, there's a tremendous amount of depth, right? There are large, dynamic header images that kind of break into the reading area. There's a lot of elements, you know, elements are with size and darkness and things like that. You're controlling how forward and back things are. It's really just classic graphic design, what you're doing.
There's nothing more than that, really. And I don't claim or think that it's anything particularly innovative. You know, I think we do nice work. But I don't think that people – I think people, you know, that they kind of – maybe it's a buzzword like Ajax or something.
Yes.
Web 2.0.
Yes.
And we're having the same conversations about flat design as we were perhaps having about rounded corners and gradients in the whole kind of Web 2.0 days. But, you know, these things are aesthetics. And, you know, obviously – when an aesthetic kind of takes hold, it is quite hard to design away from it sometimes. Mm-hmm. And you know, I'm sure that we're guilty of that as much as anything else. The thing is to always have a reason behind why you want to flatten something.
Yeah. Go on.
Well, and that's how I look at it. Right. I think that, you know, obviously slavishly following any kind of design trend is a short-term gain.
Well, that's kind of what you do when you're a beginner, when you're a junior, right? You copy things, you master. It's like, you know, the first thing I did as a designer was master Photoshop or think I had. You can never master Photoshop. And like, and all those, oh my gosh, the glows, you know, all the really horrible stuff that we were doing back in the 90s. I got really good at doing that.
And
then you forget it. And then you like push it behind you with embarrassment, but you have to go through that period.
And there are always ebbs and flows in any, you know, any industry, any art form, any medium. You know, what we're seeing is no different from, you know, changes in taste in art, for example, over the years. And what I find offensive sometimes is people will they'll dismiss a design because of the flat aesthetic, just out of hand, you know, without actually critiquing maybe the reasons why something looks that way, or, you know, lots of other decisions. You know, the flatness of the design or the flatness of the colors is only one component in the design, but they'll dismiss it out of hand. Whereas nobody dismissed Robert Rauschenberg and went, man, you know, no, who wants to paint with big dots anymore?
Right.
You know, nobody dismissed the pop artists until, obviously, you know,
actually,
it moved on to the next movement.
I think a lot of critics did, but I think they were wrong. So that those critics were wrong. So I'm with you.
Now, and I'm not saying for one minute that people are going to look back in, you know, 60 years time and go, man, those shots on Dribbble were amazing. In the same way that we might look at a Warhol. But, you know, there are ebbs and flows in everybody's taste.
when you do, do you love responsive design, or is it just a necessary evil? Are you enjoying it, or does it kind of piss you off?
No, I actually really like it because I think that it gives us more things to think about. And I think that it makes what we do much more of the medium. And I think for a very long time, you know, from the start of the web, and I know Jeremy Keith will say, well, you know, the web was always fluid. But for the majority of people like me who were designing websites, the web was never fluid. The web was generally a fixed width 960 canvas. Right.
Our client defined it, or we argued with the client to go for a bigger fixed width or a smaller fixed width. Right.
So for a lot of people, that was how web design was done, and they fought against it. They resisted any change, really.
Do you remember? Do you remember? Were you around for web design before that? Like when I started, I did a lot of liquid design. If you remember, what that would, and looked like it looked terrible. It looked terrible. There was, you know, there would be certain states in which things looked good, and then there were awful states in which, you know, type was unreadable because the measure was like ridiculously wide, and nothing seemed related to each other. So I think the rejection of the natural liquidity of the web, it wasn't a mindless thing. I think it was first people tried to do it the web's way, but there weren't the tools to do it the web's way and have a design that made sense.
I mean, think how differently the web would have been if Internet Explorer 5 and 6 had supported max width. Because we would have likely done much, much more liquid design because we could have capped that width as we do now. But of course, we couldn't do that because those versions of Internet Explorer didn't support that CSS
property.
That's
what I'm saying.
So the only way, because obviously
and earlier that property didn't exist.
No,
when I started doing it, it didn't even exist. So if you did liquid design, it meant if someone had a really big monitor or a really high resolution, it was going to be bad for them. So, you know, no matter.
Yeah, and so therefore we stuck with the fixed width route as long as we could, and it was only when. It was only after responsive design, I suppose. I mean, I know, again, that's like a nice umbrella term, but it was only after we were really forced to take that into account. I mean, I had a client phone up today, new prospect phoned up today, and one of the things that she said was, and of course I want it to look great on my iPad. You know, so this is not something that geeks are pushing. This is something that clients are asking for. And and actually, I'm sure Ethan wishes that he got a dollar for every time somebody used the phrase because, he'd have a lot more than $3 now.
Yeah.
Because, you know, that's gone into the common vernacular. People know what responsive design is. We know when you take a taxi ride.
Although the fact that Ethan doesn't make a dollar every time someone does it is why we love him. Right. If you invented something and then immediately figured out how to keep it to yourself and market it and make a buck off anyone trying to use it, there's nothing wrong with that under capitalism, but it wouldn't have the same feeling. Ethan, I feel like, just gave us this huge gift. He said, here's this idea. You guys want to try this?
Right. I wouldn't love him any less if he had a yacht.
I wouldn't love him.
I'd go on his yacht.
I wouldn't love him less if he had a yacht either. True.
If you own a football team.
All I mean is the openness of sharing is part of what we love about web design. You know what I meant.
Well, this is one of the things that I'm going to be talking about. Man, I'm bringing this back around to the talk that we started off with. But one of the things that I'm going to be mentioning in my Event Apart talk next week is all of these wonderful things, all of the things that are going to be talked about at the show next week are building blocks. And we should know and have the tools for being able to absorb that information. But instead of following somebody else's path, we should pave our own. And when we do that, the most important thing that we can do is to share back what we've discovered. Because, you know, that's how we all got here. You know, we wouldn't have been... we wouldn't have been doing any of this if it hadn't have been, for example, for those people that wrote Alistair Part articles 10 years ago.
And this brings us back to your point about you. I wouldn't be talking to you now, perhaps, if you hadn't been blogging and sharing 10 years ago.
No, and I feel very privileged to have been able to do all the things that we've done.
I know, this is an amazing time.
And I'm very grateful. And some people say, you know, we get emails. I'm sure you get exactly the same thing saying, you know, well, first of all, how do I get started? But also, how do you get work? You know, I'm just setting up. I'm just thinking about going freelance. It's some of the things I talk about on my podcast. Mm-hmm. People say, you know, how do I get work? What's the best way of attracting new business? Well, I get new business by actually just doing stuff and sharing it and talking about it and being an active part of the industry. And that's what I recommend that you do.
Yep. I think that's a good place to close. But I will point out that you have a wonderful podcast called Unfinished Business. Unfinished Biz. And we'll make sure that the URLs are on the show page when we're done. I really want to thank you for your time today.
I'll see you in a couple of days.
I'll see you in a couple of days. I'm really excited to hear your presentation. And I am really hopeful that after you've given it a few times, you'll want to write about this too, so that you can share it with people who can't be at a conference. So thank you, Andy Clark. And as a reminder, this episode was brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. For a free trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and use offer code FREELANCE, FREELANCE, FREELANCE. Squarespace has over 20 highly customizable templates for you to choose from. It's easy to use, but if you want some help, they have a support team that works 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Start a trial with no credit card required and start building your website. When you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure to use the offer code FREELANCE to get 10% off and to show your support for The Big Web Show. We thank Squarespace for their support of The Big Web Show, and I thank Andy Clark for his time, his contributions to web design, and for the dynamite talk I know he's going to give in a couple of days in Atlanta. Sir, I will see you in Atlanta.
Cheers, mate. I'll see you then.
See you. Bye-bye.